From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor, writer, and comic Steve Martin. His novel, The Pleasure of My Company, is out in paperback next week. One reviewer praised it for its complex mix of wit, poignancy, and Martin's clear, great affection for his characters. Also, the original Star Wars trilogy has just been released as a new DVD box set. We'll hear from actor James Earl Jones. He evoked fear as the voice of Darth Vader, but as a child, a stutter made him too frightened to speak. Film critic David Edelstein reviews The Motorcycle Diaries, and we have a review of the new ABC series Desperate Housewives. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military says nearly 100 Iraqi insurgents have been killed in an assault on the city of Samarra. U.S. and Iraqi forces are trying to regain control of the city and its government buildings. NPR's Emily Harris is embedded with U.S. forces in Samarra, where she says security has been a problem.
Samarra has been a kind of no-go zone for the U.S. military, meaning that they can come in here, but they get shot at. And that's been going on for quite some time now. And the intent of this operation on the city is exactly that, to retake control of Samarra. The main focus of this operation has been to get control of the police stations and city buildings. Not that they were necessarily being held by insurgents, but those are the key buildings that the U.S. is trying to take control of.
NPR's Emily Harris in Samarra. Israeli troops killed at least 7 Palestinians today in an assault on a huge refugee camp in Gaza. More than 24 Palestinians died in the fighting yesterday, along with at least 3 Israelis. Israel says the offensive comes after a Hamas rocket killed 2 Israeli children in a border town on Wednesday. NPR's Linda Gradstein says the Israeli army is ready to stay for some time.
Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz yesterday said that the army is preparing for a prolonged operation. He said that basically the army has decided that it's going to stay in the northern Gaza Strip until they feel fairly certain that they will have cut down significantly on the number of Qassam rocket attacks. The Palestinians have been using improved Qassam rockets that now have a range of about 6 miles.
NPR's Linda Gradstein. A former Boeing executive has been sentenced to 9 months in prison. When she worked at the Pentagon, Darlene Druyan negotiated a multi-billion dollar deal for the Air Force to lease refueling tankers from Boeing. She then took a job with the giant aircraft maker. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Druyan admitted that as the negotiator for the government, she gave Boeing pricing information from its only competitor, then sweetened the $23 billion price for Boeing, then tried to obstruct the investigation. The tanker contract was almost a done deal in 2002 when skeptical lawmakers brought it to a halt. It's now under review. Druyan said she helped Boeing or gave it a higher price in other contracts as well. She told prosecutors she wanted Boeing to hire her, and she got the company to hire her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend, too. She said she raised the price on the tankers as a parting gift to Boeing, prosecutors said. When Boeing fired Druyan, it also fired the executive who hired her. The government is still investigating his case. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 112 points today to close at 10,192 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 45 to 1942. This is NPR News. A suicide bomber blew himself up inside a mosque in Pakistan today, killing at least 25 people during Friday prayers. Officials say dozens of people were wounded in the attack on a Shiite mosque in the city of Sialkot. Police say they found and defused a second bomb outside the mosque shortly after the initial attack. Officials say the second bomb could have killed dozens more people who'd gathered outside the building. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. About 10,000 cocktail waitresses, bartenders, and other employees in Atlantic City casinos went on strike this morning after their union and the casinos failed to reach agreements. Aries Keck reports from member station WHYY in Philadelphia.
It's now a bit tougher to get room service or even order a cocktail at 7 Atlantic City casinos. Workers there have gone on strike. Carol Ball has been a cocktail waitress for 23 years. She's a member of the union's contract committee. She says one key demand is getting an agreement aligned with the national union that would put Atlantic City contracts on the same timeline as those in Las Vegas.
A 3-year contract puts us in line with the rest of our brothers and sisters throughout the nation. These are national properties, and it would definitely put us all on the same page.
The Trump Hotels agreed to a 3-year deal late last night. All the casinos are open, as the strike does not involve dealers. Casino executives have been pressed into service and are waiting tables. For NPR News, I'm Aries Keck in Philadelphia.
The S&P 500 gained 17 points, or 1.5% today, to close at 1131. The S&P 500 is up 21 for the week. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity, providing more than 35,000 customer reviews on hotels worldwide. Online at Travelocity.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is the great actor and comic Steve Martin, the star of such films as The Jerk, All of Me, Roxanne, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, L.A. Story, Father of the Bride, The Spanish Prisoner, Bowfinger, and Bringing Down the House. Steve Martin also has established himself as a novelist and playwright. Shop Girl, the novel he published 3 years ago, was a bestseller. He's now adapting it into a film. Martin's most recent novel, called The Pleasure of My Company, is coming out in paperback next week. If you're thinking it's a wild and crazy guy kind of story, it's not. But it is witty. It's about Daniel Pecan Cambridge, a man who has so many neurotic fears and compulsions, he seldom dares to leave his Santa Monica apartment. Terry spoke with Steve Martin last year about The Pleasure of My Company. She asked him to start with a reading.
This all started because of a clerical error. Without the clerical error, I wouldn't have been thinking this way at all. I wouldn't have had time. I would have been too preoccupied with my new friends I was planning to make at Mensa, the International Society of Geniuses. I'd taken their IQ test, but my score came back missing a digit. Where was the one that should have been in front of the 90? I fell short of the genius category by a full 50 points, barely enough to qualify me to sharpen their pencils. Thus, I was rejected from membership and facing a hopeless pile of red tape to correct the mistake. Santa Monica, California, where I live, is a perfect town for invalids, homosexuals, show people, and all other formerly peripheral members of society. Average is not the norm here. Here, if you're visiting from Omaha, you stick out like a senorita's ass at the Puerto Rican Day parade. That's why, when I saw a contest at the Rite Aid drugstore asking for a 2-page essay on why I am the most average American, I marveled that the promoters actually thought they might find an average American at this nut house by the beach. This cardboard stand carried an ad by its sponsor, Tepperton's Frozen Apple Pies. I grabbed an entry form, and as I hurried home, began composing the essay in my head. The challenge was not to present myself as average, but how to make myself likable without lying. I think I'm appealing, but likability in an essay is very different from likability in life. See, I tend to grow on people, and 500 words is just not enough to get someone to like me. I need several years and a ream or two of paper. I knew I had to flatter, overdo, and lay it on thick in order to speed up my likability time frame. So I would not like the sniveling, patriotic me who wrote my 500 words. I would like a girl with dark roots peeking out through the peroxide who was laughing so hard that Coca-Cola was coming out of her nose. And I guess you would, too. But Miss Coca-Cola Nose wouldn't be writing this essay in her Coca-Cola persona. She would straighten up, fix her hair, snap her panties out of her ass, and start typing. I am average because, I wrote, I stand on the seashore here in Santa Monica and let the Pacific Ocean touch my toes, and I know I am at the most western edge of our nation, and that I am a descendant of the settlers who came to California as pioneers. And is not every American a pioneer? Does this spirit not reside in each one of us, in every city, in every heart, on every rural road, in every traveler, in every Winnebago, in every American living, in every mansion or slum? I am average, I wrote, because the cry of individuality flows confidently through my blood with little attention drawn to itself, like the still power of an apple pie sitting in an open window to cool. I hope the Mensa people never see this essay, not because it reeks of my manipulation of a poor company just trying to sell pies, but because, during the 24 hours it took me to write it, I believed so fervently in its every word.
Thank you. That's Steve Morton reading from his new novel, The Pleasure of My Company. Well, your character, although he's writing this essay on why he's the most average American, is very not average, wouldn't you say?
Very not. He's he's a young man in his early 30s. He's unclear in the book about his real age, which he doesn't reveal until the last couple of pages for a reason you'll find out later. And he's isolated. He's a kind of a benign neurotic. He has certain rituals. He can't cross the street at the curb. He has to find two opposing scooped-out driveways. He has to keep the wattage in his apartment constant at 1,125 watts. For example, if he turns out a light in his bedroom, he must turn on a light in the living room or kitchen. And it's only a three-room house. And this is a story of how his life finally opens up, as he describes himself, that he has narrowed his life down to keep everything out. In fact, his stated goal was to have so many rules and conditions that he could control everything that was coming into him, and then he would slowly open the doors one at a time.
Now, your character wants to get into Mensa, and he thinks they made some kind of clerical error, leaving off the number one before his 90. You also wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Mensa.
Yes. As I say, there was a precursor to this.
Right, right.
And I think that I needed to start that way in order to kind of go back to that essay, revisit that character in my head, and kick it off from where I left it off before.
What does Mensa mean to you? I mean, it's this group of people with high IQs get
right.
together.
I always saw it in this way. Okay, well, you might have a high IQ, but what have you done lately? And I think the real stroke of genius is in what you do and not in some score.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it a little bit cynically. I have no cynicism toward any Mensa member, but it was just the way I looked at the world, that the accomplishments are what matters and not scores.
I'd be interested in hearing why you want your writing to be writing for the page as opposed to writing for the screen.
Well, I started writing in 1965. When I wrote little essays in college that later became a book I published called Cruel Shoes. And then I was writing for my comedy act throughout the 60s and 70s. And then in the late 70s, I started writing screenplays, co-writing them with, other writers, The Jerk and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Of course, right, right.
And then in the late, mid-80s, I started writing solo screenplays. Roxanne, an L.A. Story, and Simple Twist of Fate. And then I really have written a lot of screenplays, Bowfinger, too. And then in the early 90s, I really got a call from the New York Times asking me to write something on this. There was a discovery of a Michelangelo statue here in New York City. So I wrote a little parody of that and went into The New Yorker ultimately. Actually, the truth is I really enjoy writing for the page because it's an utterly different thing. You know, a screenplay is description and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And a book is really about sentences and paragraphs and their structure and their rhythm and the use of words, the exact, precise use of words. You know, in a screenplay can be, you know, I remember one year I saw a little list in a magazine of, the best lines from the movies this year. And they were all like, come on, let's get out of here.
The catchphrases.
Yeah, yeah. And, it's just a very different, what your best line in a movie is very different from a best line in a book. So it's a completely different enterprise.
You know, as an actor, particularly early in your career, your persona was usually very extroverted. As a writer, like your two novels are about really introverted characters. I think that's an interesting contrast.
Well, I think actually that without, being too boring, analyzing my sort of stage act, that character, sorry to talk about that in that way, but he was a bit crazy. He was a little, I was on stage. This, very similar to this character, really. It's like a, on stage I was really just expressing a perverse thought on the way the world worked. And I remember this one bit I did was that I was, I was so mad at my mother. I used to scream it, of course, because she wanted to borrow $10 for some food. And, you know, there's some kind of link here between this character who just sees things in the odd way.
All writers talk about, you know, facing the blank page and so on, but it really is true that the difference between being an actor and being on the set and being, you know, working with other people is so different than staying at home and writing.
Right.
Do you like that more isolated process of writing?
Well, you know, they complement each other so well because, like you say, movies are active and social and physical, and writing is solitary and personal. And I never wanted to be an actor who sat home and waited for scripts to come through the door. I mean, I just it'd drive me insane, waiting and hoping and so I always wrote and I always did comedy, and I just liked I like the activity of it. You know, I just find that when I'm idle, which I always enjoy, I always find that something comes up, something pops up. So I'll get out the computer and start typing.
Do you think you approach writing with a different personality than the one you approach acting with?
I would have to say yes, because, you know, it's just so different. They are completely different. But I really think that my acting has influenced my writing, because as an actor, you finally, as you get a little better at it, you realize you're observing character. And you realize that it's the details that make character. It's the little tiny actions. And so in writing, I think I realize, or at least I like, to pick up those details that determine character.
And those are the same kinds of things you have to pick up when you're acting, too, aren't they? I mean, you're not
describing
them, you're doing them. Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's from acting. But the strange thing about acting is it's also what you don't do. I mean, it's almost a thought process in your head that is so expressive. So the more you can detail it in your mind, and without, you know, what we call in acting indicating an emotion. I remember once the director, Herb Ross, he was mad at an actress. And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Well, she's supposed to be mad. She's supposed to be mad." And I said, "Well, she's yelling." And he says, "Yes, but anger has 1,000 faces." And I always remembered that. It's like, oh, yes, some of the angriest moments I've ever felt are when I did nothing or said nothing and expressed nothing.
Right.
So there's always those choices in behavior.
Steve Martin is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Pleasure of My Company. You know, I think it's hard when you're so accomplished at something to try something that you're new to, as you were new to writing novels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, when you're at the top of your profession in one thing and then you're brand new to something else, you can fail, you can be flawed, and you can be very insecure. You have no track record. So did starting to write bring out insecurities that you weren't used to because...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there's a trick when you first start writing.
Teach it to me, please.
Well... You don't have to show it to anybody.
Right.
When you're sitting there alone and you haven't, you know, made a deal with somebody to deliver a book, mm-hmm. you're really on your own. And you can, it's like putting your toe in the water. You can have written something and you give it to a friend or you ask someone's opinion. So it never has, you always fooled yourself because, you know, and the reason I say you fool yourself, ultimately you do want it to be out there. But you fool yourself by saying, it doesn't matter. I can be lousy. No one will ever see it if it's lousy. And, of course, they do see it, and sometimes it's lousy.
So you would agree that self-delusion is an important part of writing?
Very, very important. I really do. I think it is. It's like, I remember the first night I previewed my play, Picasso at the Lapin Agile. I'd never written a play. I'd written screenplays, but I was in Melbourne, Australia, and now it's 10 minutes before curtain, and all I could think is, what have I done? I didn't know if there's going to be a laugh, anything. It was just, it could have been so humiliating. But then only, 40 people would have seen it, and I could have gone home with my tail between my legs. But I just like to add that I really don't have a tail.
Steve Martin speaking last year with Terry Gross. His novel, The Pleasure of My Company, is coming out in paperback next week. More after the break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Steve Martin about his novel, The Pleasure of My Company. The paperback comes out next week.
Do you write many drafts before publishing?
What I do is I write without inhibiting myself. And then I will... A draft is not quite the right word in my head. I go through and I start editing. And I start reading it, and I start reading it over and over and over, which can get very tiresome. So sometimes I'll put it down for 3 months, come back, read it again. Then I'll read it aloud to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll read it to my dog. And I find that reading it aloud makes you catch every word. And to me, every word is important. Because I'm a... I'm a reader who gets bored quickly, so I need to have these sentences on the move and be interesting all the time. So I try to catch everything.
Is your dog helpful when you're reading to him?
Well, he's my audience. I'm not looking for his response.
You just need somebody to read to.
Yeah.
Did you feel an obligation to be funny when you started writing? Because that's what people expect of you.
Well, no, because the first book, Shop Girl, although it has funny moments, I wouldn't call it a funny book.
Right.
But in Pleasure of My Company, I actually wanted the book to be funny. And I knew that I had a character who could be funny. And I, it's really, whenever I start even a New Yorker essay, I have the idea, I think, okay, what is the potential of this? I have no idea what the individual bits will be or moments or anything, but does it seem rich or does it seem I'm going to run out of steam in a couple of paragraphs? And I felt with this character, he could really keep going. And it's a cliche to talk about the discovery of character as you keep writing, but I found that my mind retains little details of things I've written 40 or 50 pages ago. And so something that you wrote that was very, very casual, a little aside, a little something he did, comes back at a certain moment and it becomes big. Because now this tiny little thing impacts something else. And it's like this, it's like weaving a web or weaving a something else, a caftan, I don't know, which I'm weaving. But that's what I really like, is where the details start to add up.
Well, you've had your success in the book world and the film world, and you've been on the bestseller list, and you're probably the only person to have hosted both the Academy Awards and the National Book Awards.
I guess I am.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'll have to stop any Oscar host from hosting the National Book Awards so I can keep my uniqueness.
So, I think that would probably give you a good seat as to some of the differences between the two worlds, the film world and the book world.
Well, the differences, the book world is much, much slower
mm-hmm.
than the film world. I mean, the the film world is so oriented to promotion and getting the word out in certain ways, getting the word out in very vibrant ways and very specific soundbite ways. And for example, I mean, here I am talking to you for 40 minutes about my book. This would never happen about a film. I mean, in terms of the way a film is generally promoted, but it's the way books are promoted. They're talked about in depth in much slower ways.
Well, and the numbers are so much smaller too, aren't they?
Right.
Like a best-selling book probably doesn't come close to the ticket sales of a mediocre-selling movie.
Probably, yeah. But you know what I found is that when I started writing for The New Yorker, I noticed I got more reaction from one essay, and I'm talking about actual reaction that I could feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people saying things, than I did for movies, like entire movies that cost millions and millions of dollars to come out, and I would hear, you know, very little, or somebody would say, nice movie or something. But these essays, they started to, I guess it's because they're so intimate with the reader. They're so intimately involved that it stays with them longer. You know, a movie, sometimes I walk out, I've forgotten it, you know, as I'm exiting the lobby.
Steve Martin, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His novel, The Pleasure of My Company, will be released next week in paperback. Here's Steve Martin trying to impress the audience from his 1978 comedy album, A Wild and Crazy Guy.
Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price. That's right, for every one you buy, I get two. So I can just have about as much as I want, you know what I mean? And it doesn't affect me. No, I'm not on this stuff. Okay, I have had a lot of fun since I've been here. I do like coming to San Francisco because it's an intellectual town. And that's kind of what I'm into. I dig the intellectual kind of thing. And I had a good time since I've been here. I know that sounds phony, because every entertainer in the world comes out, no matter where they are, and they go, hey, it's really great to be here. And it really sounds fake, but I am sincere when I say, hey, it's really great to be here.
And transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, James Earl Jones. When he played the voice of Darth Vader, he had no idea how big the Star Wars films would become or what it would do for his career. There's a new DVD box set of the Star Wars trilogy. Also, reviews of the new ABC series Desperate Housewives and the film The Motorcycle Diaries. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. And since I'm sitting here, let's talk some television.
My name is Mary Alice Young. When you read this morning's paper, you may come across an article about the unusual day I had last week. Normally, there's never anything newsworthy about my life, but that all changed last Thursday. Of course,
that's the opening of Desperate Housewives, the new ABC series premiering this Sunday. What changed in Mary Alice's life that day is that it ended. She killed herself, and no one else in the neighborhood knows why, even though everyone in every home harbors at least one juicy secret. And just because Mary Alice, played by Brenda Strong, dies in the opening scene, that doesn't keep her from narrating the rest of the story. She's looking at her neighborhood now from a distant, somewhat amused vantage point, and so are we. Desperate Housewives is an hour-long soap opera that's heavy on the dark comedy, but is filled with lots of characters you can relate to as well as laugh at. It's the best show of the new season and one of the most original. It's also got one of the strongest and most unusual casts around. Desperate Housewives, created by Mark Cherry, is headlined not by one female star or two, but five. Most have starred in their own TV shows before, and they all deserve equal billing on this one. Listen to this lineup. Felicity Huffman, who was so great in Sports Night, plays Lynette, a former corporate executive who traded that life to have kids, four of them in 3 years. She's the walking definition of frazzled. Terry Hatcher, who humanized Lois Lane in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, plays Susan, a suddenly single mother coping with being unexpectedly dumped by her husband for a younger woman. Nicolette Sheridan, a veteran vixen from Knott's Landing, plays Edie, the neighborhood's sex symbol and sexual predator. Eva Longoria, who's coming to primetime from The Young and the Restless, plays Gabrielle, an ex-model trophy wife with a taste for vengeful affairs. And Marcia Cross, who was so deliciously twisted in Melrose Place, plays Bree, a Martha Stewart type whose outer perfection masks some inner turmoil. Like the other women on Wisteria Lane, Bree reacts to her friend's suicide by showing up at the wake bearing comfort food for the new widower, Paul, played by Mark Moses. Brenda Strong, from her heavenly perspective as Mary Alice, describes the scene.
Bree Vandekamp, who lives next door, brought baskets of muffins she baked from scratch. Bree was known for her cooking, and for making her own clothes, and for doing her own gardening, and for reupholstering her own furniture. Yes, Bree's many talents were known throughout the neighborhood, and everyone on Wisteria Lane thought of Bree as the perfect wife and mother. Everyone, that is, except her own family.
Paul. Zachary.
Hello, Mrs. Vandekamp.
Bree, you shouldn't have gone to all this trouble.
It was no trouble at all. Now, the basket with the red ribbon is filled with desserts for your guests. But the one with the blue ribbon is just for you and Zachary. It's got rolls, muffins, breakfast type things.
Thank you.
Well, the least I could do was make sure you boys had a decent meal to look forward to in the morning. I know you're out of your minds with grief.
Yes, we are.
Of course, I will need the baskets back once you're done.
Of course.
Every one of these women has at least one wonderful scene in the pilot. Some are steamy, some are funny, some are even poignant. But Desperate Housewives, most of all, is a flat-out wry comedy served up in a one-hour dose, with no laugh track, lots of intelligence, and with the goodwill ensemble feel of a repertory theater company. These actresses all seem to know they've been handed something terrific here, and each one not only matches the material, but adds something to it. Desperate Housewives is a new show you really shouldn't miss. And this fall, those kinds of shows are precious. Watch Desperate Housewives on Sunday and be prepared to talk about it on Monday. It has the smell, the home-baked yummy smell, of an instant hit. Coming up, the voice of Darth Vader, James Earl Jones. This is Fresh Air. James Earl Jones has a voice that conveys power and authority. He also tends to lend that voice to projects that turn out to surf some of the biggest tidal waves of the cultural zeitgeist.
There is no escape. Don't make me destroy you. Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough! He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father. Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No! No!
Jones was the ominous and evil voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars movies. The Star Wars trilogy has just been released on DVD. This year, Jones also provides one of the voices in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. Yet in his memoir, called Voices and Silences, James Earl Jones talked about all the trouble his voice has caused him. In the book, he writes about his personal life and his varied and distinguished career. On stage, in such plays as The Blacks, The Blood Knot, The Great White Hope, Othello, and Fences. In films, such as Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and Summersby. And on TV, including the miniseries Roots the Next Generation and his own series Gabriel's Fire and Paris. Jones grew up in rural Mississippi. His family moved to Michigan when he was still a boy. In retrospect, he credits this uprooting with causing his stutter. As a child, the stutter was very bad. In fact, there was a period between the ages of 6 and 14 when he barely spoke at all. Terry talked with James Earl Jones in 1993.
I did the basics. I was able to function as a farm kid, doing all those chores where you call animals. I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened. I didn't want to confront them. And I wasn't ready. I hid in the state of muteness.
Did you not want to speak, or did you feel physically unable to speak?
It was just too embarrassing.
Because of the stutter?
And too difficult, yeah. There's some serious framework around the problem of stuttering, but it, at the same time, although it is totally incorrect for me to say this, politically incorrect, stutterers are very funny. I mean, when I evoked laughter in the Sunday school class from the kids behind me because I stuttered, I understood that. I understand how funny it is, but it's also very painful, you know.
Can you tell us the story of how you started speaking again?
Donald Crouch was an associate of...
Donald Crouch was your teacher?
Yeah, Robert Frost. He was a college professor, but he ended up in this high school because he retired. He was a Mennonite farmer, and he retired to his farm in Brethren, Michigan. And the idea that there were kids down the road at this high school who were studying Chaucer and Shakespeare and stuff, he couldn't stand it, so he came back and taught high school, you know. He was the first English teacher I had. Now, see, I'm stuttering again. He was the first English teacher I had. And he accepted that I wasn't verbal, that I wasn't oral. But he didn't like the idea that I could privately, subjectively enjoy poetry and not sound it out loud. He one day discovered that I wrote poetry, and he said to me, this poem is so good, I don't think you really wrote it. I think you plagiarized it, which was a shock to me. And I could admit that it was Longfellow-esque, but it was not certainly stolen from Longfellow. And he said, the way you can prove it to me that you wrote it was to get up in front of the class and recite it by heart. And I accepted the challenge and did it, and we both realized then we had a way of regaining the power of speech through reading poetry.
What was it about having words written down for you that made it easier for you to speak?
Not that they were written down, but they're rhythmic. I think you'll find many stutterers today. I'm trying to think of the country western singer who is a stutterer but does not stutter when he sings. But there are many, many cases like Mel Tillotts. Thank you, Mel Tillotts. And there are many cases like that, actors, singers who don't have that problem when they are performing. Walk off stage and you can't understand the word they're saying. It had to do with the rhythm. Rhythm carries us through. It smooths out those areas that allow the log jamming and the stuttering to be triggered.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stutter come back very much for you?
You've heard it several times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's always with me, you know, and I have to be careful not to talk too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly becomes a problem whenever I do something emotional, whether in real life or as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I hit an emotional speech, whether it's a positive emotion or a negative,
yeah,
joy or pain, and that often leads to overload, and I have to be very careful. There was a time when my acting was affected by it. I think Gladys Vaughn was the first to notice it. She says, when you get emotional, when your Othello, for instance, gets emotional, I sometimes believe you less. And it's because I'm being too careful. You can't measure out emotion. It has a flow.
Could you give us a sense of the kinds of exercises or the type of training that you had that helped you find the power in your voice? Because you have a very powerful voice.
Oh, the exercises were... I got to move back a bit.
Okay.
Sweet, peek, peek, peek. Hog calling, uh-huh. Cattle calling.
That's something you did on the farm without having to go to a voice.
My dad always said that the reason he became an actor was because even in grade school, and he didn't have a whole lot of it, but even in grade school, he was the loudest kid in class.
From calling the animals.
So he was destined to be an actor. And that's kind of true, though. Farm kids are never told, hush, you wake the neighbors. Farm kids are told, use your voice to get those cows in here.
So you think you developed that power on the farm long before acting class?
Yeah, and also it is also genetic. I inherited whatever resonating chambers my father possesses. They're not too dissimilar from Paul Robeson and another actor of my generation, Jeffrey Holder.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Darth Vader voice became a mystery, people thought, as many people thought it was Jeffrey Holder as who thought it was me. And that has to do with just how a voice is produced, you know, how it
resonates,
you know,
in the head, yeah, and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, in the head and in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In your memoir, Voices and Silences, you devote a total of about a paragraph to Star Wars, to your voice as Darth Vader. And I got the impression that it's not something you really want to call that much attention to.
Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. Not true. It's just that I have very little to talk about.
Okay.
Had I been one of the actors and given points, I would not only be wealthy, I'd be probably much better known.
Got a flat fee?
Oh, yeah. I think George Lucas... first of all, realized that although David Prowse was the actor he wanted, it was not the sound he wanted. So he searched around for a technically and symbolically a darker voice.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually came to me and said to Lucy, would Jenny like to earn a day's salary? The job took 2.5 hours. They paid me all of $9,000, which was not bad for 2.5 hours of work.
Right.
None of us knew what we had,
right.
You know, and that was fine. Almost not out of embarrassment, but out of his traditionally his non-traditional traditional capitalism, or lack of capitalism, George gave me a Christmas bonus that amounted to the same amount of money. But I was just acting as special effects. That's all that was. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was having done the Great White Hope film. I'd become a member of the board of directors of the Oscar board, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, at a time when the controversy over whether Mercedes McCambridge deserved credit for her contributions to the Linda Blair's voice, the devil coming
in The Exorcist.
Yeah, in The Exorcist. And I thought there was a silly argument that I said to myself that all the Mercedes is special effects. And I wanted to keep that clear in my case, so I didn't even take credit for the voice of Darth Vader.
Forgive me, I know this is a small part of your career, but I have to ask you about the CNN voice. The first time someone said to me, you know, I think that's James Earl Jones, I said, nah. You know, I realized, no, they're right. And of course, everybody knows this now, that you do the voice of CNN. Why did you decide to take that on when you were offered it?
You asked me what is the Star Wars involvement meant to me. What it did, it made my voice viable in the commercial world. But I don't know why. Really, I avoided that great way to make a living and great craft unto itself. But the Star Wars sort of put my name on the A list, as they say out there, for authoritative voices.
So your attitude was, why not take advantage of it?
My attitude? Yeah. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why kick something that's going to sit on your lap out of the house? I mean, I think the first commercials I did, one for Chrysler, and one for Goodyear, and one for Fisher products, audio products, and they asked me to just give us the sound of God. Goodyear Vector tires, you know. Let God sell Goodyear Vector tires.
No problem.
They were not embarrassed about saying that, you know.
So do you have a voice of yours that you think of the voice of God?
No. It just the sound is let it go as bass as it can go and still be clear.
Yeah,
and to sound like I mean it. And there's not a product I've ever promoted that I don't use, including Wells Lamont gloves, working man's gloves,
and of course the Yellow Pages,
and Ruben's dinners out in Ruben's chain of restaurants. Orson Welles and Vincent Price and I were once asked to simply on a recording read the menu. With as much slobbering, lustful sounds as we can conjure. And we got paid for it.
One quick, very quick last question. Have you ever been in a kind of difficult situation, either on the verge of being mugged or given a traffic ticket that you didn't want to pay or something, where you used your big, authoritative voice to intimidate the other person?
Last time I was mugged, it was multiple muggings, because my first visit to St. Louis, Missouri, at the age of 14, I was mugged several times one afternoon before I figured out what was going on. And in those days, you didn't always get killed when you got mugged.
Right.
You got surrounded by a bunch of kids. They said, give me your money. I said, okay. Being a farm kid, what, you fight over some movie change? The idea of fighting didn't occur to me. So therefore, I was quite safe. The only time I've used the voice, though, in my adult life, was when I got my first CB radio, and I used the Darth Vader as my handle. panicked a few people on a cross country drive from New York to Los Angeles, and I've not done it since.
James Earl Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. He'll provide the voice of Darth Vader again in next year's Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith, the final entry in the George Lucas space epic. And you can hear James Earl Jones as Darth Vader now in the just-released DVD box set of the first Star Wars trilogy. Coming up, a review of the film The Motorcycle Diaries. This is Fresh Air. The Motorcycle Diaries stars Gael Garcia Bernal, the young Mexican actor from E2 Mama Tambien, as the young Ernesto Guevara, before he became the guerrilla leader known as Che. The film is based partly on Che's diaries, which recount his momentous and consciousness-raising 8,000-mile journey across South America as a 23-year-old medical student. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Robert Redford has done many heroic things for the independent film movement, but as a filmmaker, his name stands for the blandest kind of humanism, liberal in thrust, but that thrust could hardly dent a marshmallow. He's the executive producer of The Motorcycle Diaries, and here he is on why he picked the Brazilian filmmaker Walter Salles to direct. "I knew that Walter would handle the story with lyricism and humanity," he said, rather than focusing on the politics of who Ernesto would later become. The movie Salles made, from a script by Jose Rivera, is so awesomely beautiful to look at, you want to sink to your knees. Salles and his French cinematographer Eric Gautier retraced much of the 1952 journey of Guevara and his amigo Alberto Granado. Che, a medical student, is 23. Alberto, a biochemist, 29. They're upper-middle-class young men with a starry-eyed notion of traversing South America on Alberto's ramshackle 13-year-old motorcycle, which they nickname the Mighty One, and which predictably sputters to a halt at regular intervals. They travel from Argentina to Chile and into the mountains of Peru. And these aren't picture postcard images. The camera is both restless and contemplative. The cinematography somehow imbues the landscape with the onlooker's thrill and spiritual hunger. You can almost touch the huge clouds passing over the dark mountains and feel the icy sharpness of the deep blue rivers. The Motorcycle Diaries is transporting, and yes, it's so lyrical that you almost don't notice how stiff and programmatic it is, and how undramatized. The working poor shuffle on, photographed in the Walker Evans manner, and excerpts from Che's actual diary inform us that their faces are tragic and haunting, and that time with them on a cold night makes him feel closer to the human race. In the supernally green Peruvian mountains, Che and Alberto come upon the ruins of an Incan civilization wiped out by the capitalist Spanish conquerors. "How can we feel nostalgia for a civilization we never knew?" wonders Che in voiceover. By now, the friends are ennobled. Although they tried to scam free lodging by posing as leprosy experts, they're soon doing actual good works in a leper colony, defying the nuns who insist on a strict distance between caregiver and patient. His moment of epiphany is when the asthmatic Che swims across a dangerous channel at night to share his 24th birthday with the disenfranchised lepers. It's a rousing finish. Not for nothing did the film win a much-reported standing ovation at the Sundance Film Festival. The director uses Gael Garcia Bernal as an object of frail beauty. He has pillowy lips like Julia Roberts and a soft demeanor, his dreamy eyes fixed on the horizon. He's a picture-perfect budding martyr, but he hasn't been filled in. Salles reportedly trimmed scenes of Che sharing a prostitute with Alberto and having sex with a leper. This gorgeous movie is generic and sexless. More important, it's incomplete. Michael Almereyda, who did the modern Hamlet with Ethan Hawke, had a Che script I read a few years ago. It was a romantic portrait, too, of the same period, but it ended not with Che bidding a tender farewell to Alberto, but with his decision to embrace violence and his first guerrilla kill. That strikes me as a more honest and gutsy way to connect the dots. It wasn't Che's awareness of historic injustice against the working class and the indigenous peoples of both American continents that made him one of the most galvanic figures of the 20th century. It was how he used that awareness to transform himself into a romantic symbol of righteous violence, violence that led to the overthrow of corrupt and murderous governments, but also to wanton executions and prison camps. Turning the birth of Che the Revolutionary into a story of lyricism and humanity is to throw out the most fascinating and unique part of the story and turn politics into middlebrow art movie myth.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Joan Tui-Westman, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. By Bantam Books, publisher of Fortress America, On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state by Matthew Brzezinski. And by the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity October 3rd. GIC on the web at germany.unity.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, visiting a hospital for laughs, we talk with Zach Braff, the star of the medical TV sitcom Scrubs, and the show's creator and executive producer, Bill Lawrence. We also discuss Garden State, the well-received independent film starring and written and directed by Braff. Join us for the next Fresh Air.